Time to be honest. On the first few readings of this passage, 1 Kings chapters 5 to 7, I initially had no idea at all what God is trying to teach us. Absolutely none. I knew that the first readers of the book of 1 Kings were living in human terms, a failing kingdom, in exile in Babylon, with the temple destroyed. Surely they felt abandoned. Why rub salt in the wound and remind them of what they had? What was and is the purpose of the Old Testament temple? To help us navigate this evening's long passage, the following structure will be helpful, which hopefully will be coming up on the screen. The symmetry, as perhaps you can see, of chapters 5 to 7 points towards the central section, chapters 6, verse 11 to 13, when the Lord speaks to Solomon. And the central section is the key to understanding the whole of those chapters, chapters 5 to 7. So we're going to start right at the center there. I'll be jumping around a bit between chapters 5 to 7, so please do keep the Bibles open. I'll try and refer you to the right bits and give you time to find it. Chapter 6, verse 11. The word of the Lord came to Solomon. As for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, observe my laws and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel. Here the Lord outlines his building concerns. Verse 12, as for this temple you are building, if. We would assume that the concerns that the Lord would have for the temple, his house, would be to do with the construction and fabric of the building. Tiger would know if you install a stove, it must be at least 150 millimeters from any sidewall. Is that right, Tiger? Okay. But perhaps surprisingly, the Lord's concerns, verse 12, can be literally translated as, if you walk in my law, if you obey my law, if you obey my commands, if you walk in my commands. It seems that the Lord isn't concerned with the temple building, but only concerned with Solomon's obedience to walk and obey his commands. But in the Lord's mind, these two are intrinsically linked, for the Lord is not concerned about the temple construction, but concerned about the temple purpose. And the purpose of the temple was to house the Lord and allow him to live among his people. His concerns are not for construction, but for relationship. And if a Solomon obediently keeps the Lord's concerns, then verse 12, the Lord will fulfill through Solomon the promise he gave to David, Solomon's father. And the Lord will live among the Israelites and will not abandon his people Israel. This is momentous news. Put yourselves in the shoes of the Israelites as they look back at their mixed history. Perfection, separation, promises, slavery, salvation, wandering, law, land, judges. And now, the prospect of the Lord living among them in the temple. Finally, restoration of the relationship between the Lord and his people, a relationship that was broken in the Garden of Eden and resulted in separation, now restored as God lives among his people in the temple. And the Lord's word to Solomon in verse 11 to 13 is bookended by verse 9 and verse 14, both of which say that Solomon built the temple and finished it. Finished is the same word used in Genesis 2 when God finished the work of creation and then rested. So this temple that Solomon is building is a physical witness to the Lord's promise of relationship and rest with him forever. Can this really be true? Is Solomon the obedient king through whom the Lord's promises of relationship and rest are ultimately fulfilled? Well, Solomon certainly thinks that he is. Looking back to chapter 5, and Solomon announces to the nations that the time has come. He is the king that will fulfill the promises made to his father David. Chapter 5, verse 3, Solomon says, "Wars waged against my father David from all sides. Therefore he could not build a temple for the name of the Lord. But now, the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. And I intend, therefore, to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord told my father David when he said, 'Your son, whom I will put on your throne in your place, will build the temple for my name.'" An offspring of David, of his own flesh and blood, a man of peace and rest, Solomon, he will be the one to build a house for the name of the Lord. And so verse 6, Solomon orders Hiram, king of Tyre, to supply him with the highest grade of timber, cedar, from Lebanon. And in return, verse 11, Solomon repaid Hiram with great expense. And then verses 13 to 16, Solomon organized a workforce of approximately 180,000 men dedicated to the construction of the temple. And verse 17, he commanded skilled craftsmen to quarry out great, costly stones in order to lay the foundations of the house with dressed stones. Solomon directs his full attention, wealth and manpower, to the temple construction. The time is now. Solomon is the king who fulfills the promises made to his father David, and so he gets to work laying the foundations of precious and costly stones. And Solomon is correct in his claims. But the Lord leaves room for ambiguity in his promise that he made to David, Solomon's father. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12, the Lord says to David, "When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name." So far, Solomon fulfills all of that promise. However, the Lord goes on to say, "And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." But the original readers know, and we know, that Solomon dies, and eventually the Babylonians conquer the kingdom and destroy the temple. Therefore, how is God faithful to his promise to establish the throne of David's kingdom forever? Is Solomon the obedient king through whom the Lord's promises of relationship and rest are ultimately fulfilled? An offspring of David, a wise son, a perfectly obedient king, a king of peace and rest, a king described as a chosen and precious foundation stone whose kingdom shall know no end. Solomon has laid the foundations, and now chapter 6, verse 1, Solomon starts to build. So verse 1 of chapter 6, in the 408th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, Solomon began to build the temple of the Lord. The date given highlights the significance of this point in history. This is the only point in biblical history that an event is dated from the Exodus, the year that the Israelites were set free from slavery in Egypt, highlighting that the construction of the temple is the most significant point in history since the Exodus. In fact, all of the high points in Israel's history, the promises made to Abraham, salvation from slavery in Egypt, the covenants and commandments given to Moses, entering and settling in Canaan, the promised land, all of these high points culminate in the temple construction. The construction of the temple through the obedience of the Lord's established king, a place through which the Lord lives with his people forever, is the high point of all human history. What is the meaning of life? It's temple building. And so rightly, Solomon constructed the temple with reverence and respect. Verse 7 of chapter 6, only blocks dressed at the quarry were used. No hammer, chisel, or any other iron tool was heard at the temple site while it was being built. Think of the additional logistics and skills required to construct in this way. Tiger is nodding. You'd be mad nowadays to chisel your intricate archway keystone miles from the building site, and even madder back then. And yet, that was exactly and rightly what Solomon ordered. For this construction was like any other, a house for the Lord. But we still should have in mind the question, is Solomon the obedient king through whom the Lord's promises of relationship and rest are ultimately fulfilled? A wise builder who will destroy the temple made with human hands, and in 3 days build another not made with hands. The foundations have been laid. The temple structure has been built. And we're now told how Solomon decorated the temple. Chapter 6, verse 16. Solomon partitioned off 20 cubits at the rear of the temple with cedar boards from floor to ceiling to form within the temple an inner sanctuary, the most holy place. The inside of the temple was cedar, carved with gourds and open flowers. Everything was cedar. No stone was to be seen. And verse 29, on the walls, all around the temple, in both the inner and outer rooms, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. In terms of layout, the first two-thirds of the temple was the main hall, which led to the rear, partitioned third, the inner sanctuary, the most holy place. The walls of the main hall and inner sanctuary were dressed with intricately decorated cedar. No expense was spared. High-quality materials, high levels of skill required, and significant attention to detail. And the detailed finish was not arbitrary in design, but loaded with significance. The cedar was decorated all over with gourds or fruits, open flowers, cherubim, and palm trees. Decoration designed to remind the Israelites and subsequent readers of 1 Kings of the Garden of Eden, a time when perfection, completeness, and rest permeated the entirety of creation, and where most significantly of all, God dwelt in perfect relationship with his people. Not only were the walls decorated with carvings, but that they were then overlaid with pure gold. In fact, the whole interior was overlaid with gold. The walls, the floor, the altar of cedar, the chains across the front of the inner sanctuary, the altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary, the cherubim, and the doors to the inner sanctuary in the main hall. Bedazzled, everything was covered with gold. Was this extravagance? No. Solomon was building a house for the name of the Lord. In no way was it over the top. It was just as perfect as Solomon could possibly get to providing a suitable house for the Lord. And within the inner sanctuary, there was no way of not noticing the two massive gold-plated cherubim, each approximately 5 meters high and 5 meters wide, standing wingtip to wingtip, spanning the entire width of the room, and standing either side of the Ark of the Covenant. Do not falsely interpret angelic beings to be small-winged, naked babies. Be afraid. These cherubim were imposing and terrifying. And they were symbolic of man's exclusion from God's presence. Think back to the Garden of Eden. And it was cherubim with flaming swords that stood as a striking symbol that the Lord God can no longer dwell with man. A broken relationship. To end this chapter, verse 38, we read that the temple was finished after 7 years of building. Again, Genesis 2 language and symbolism of restoration of relationship, rest, and completeness. God living amongst his people in the temple. Is Solomon the obedient king through whom the Lord's promises of relationship and rest are ultimately fulfilled? With the temple built, it was now time to furnish it. Chapter 7, Huram, not to be confused with Hiram, the king of Tyre, was sent for by King Solomon. Huram is described as full of wisdom, understanding and skill for making any work in bronze. This is God-given gifting. And the language used to describe Huram is reminiscent of Beelzebul, who crafted the tabernacle. In chapter 7, verse 15, Huram cast in bronze two immense pillars to be erected at the entrance to the temple. Each was 9 meters high and 6 meters in circumference. Unless you were a priest, you were not allowed into the temple. As a common Israelite, the pillars were as far as you could go, and this is all you would have seen of the temple decor. And what a glorious and intimidating statement they would have made, that the temple was a dwelling place of the Lord of strength and power. But it is not the size or location of the pillars that I want to draw your attention to, but to the fact that the pillars were named. Verse 21, one was named Jachin and the other Boaz. You can understand a room being named, for example, the inner sanctuary, the most holy place. But to name a structural support seems rather obscure. But when you understand the meanings of the names, you understand why the pillars are named as they are. Boaz means in him is strength. And in the given context, it would have read as in the Lord is strength. What an apt name for a pillar at the entrance to the house of the Lord. The other was named Jachin, which given the context translates as the Lord will establish. In the Lord's promise to King David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, he promises to establish the kingdom of David's offspring and to establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And last Sunday evening, Dave showed us that in 1 Kings chapters 2 and 3, the Lord establishes Solomon as the king who will deliver wise judgment and justice. These two immense, glorious, and intimidating pillars, named Jachin and Boaz, were symbols of the Lord's promise to establish, in his strength, his wise, obedient, and just king on the throne forever. And it's not only pillars that Hiram constructed, but also one enormous and ornate basin named the sea, which would have held 22 tons of water. And it stood on the back of 12 oxen, symbolizing God's people, the 12 tribes of Israel. Alongside the sea, Hiram constructed another 10 ornate movable basins, which each held about 880 liters of water. And verse 39 of chapter 7, both the sea and the 10 basins were set outside of the temple. What a sight! An Israelite stood outside of the temple would not only have been overwhelmed by the size and significance of the pillars, but also blown away by the vast quantities of water that was needed for cleansing. Just imagine being an onlooker outside the temple on the Day of Atonement. It would have been a sensory overload. The overwhelming grandeur and significance of the temple, the ceremonial noise and busyness of the priests, and the sight and stench of rivers of water and sacrificial blood. All to allow just one man, and not King Solomon, but the high priest, to fleetingly enter in fear the most holy place, to, on behalf of God's people, sprinkle sacrificial blood on the altar to atone for sin. Is Solomon the king through whom the Lord's promises of relationship and rest are ultimately fulfilled. A chosen, established king, God's Christ, who sits on the throne and to whom belongs praise and honour and glory and power forever and ever. One through whom we have confidence to enter the most holy place by his blood, from whom flows streams of living water, and who can cleanse our hearts and wash our bodies with pure water. In summary, the imagery and symbolism of the temple construction is testimony to the Lord's promise to establish in his strength his obedient king on the throne forever, through whom restoration of relationship and rest like that experienced in the Garden of Eden will be brought about. But as an Israelite, is that what it would have looked and felt like? Immense, glorious and intimidating pillars standing either side of the entrance to God's dwelling place with man in the inner sanctuary, the most holy place, guarded by two imposing and terrifying cherubim, accessible only once a year on the Day of Atonement by the high priest, after a sensory overload worth of sacrificial cleansing. Yes, Solomon was God's established king, who built the temple so that God could live with his people, but not freely live. There were significant barriers. Ultimately, the temple was a reminder of God's holiness and man's unholiness, of God's faithfulness and man's faithlessness, of the need for a perfect, obedient, saving king enthroned forever, through whom man can freely dwell and enjoy being with God. This side of the cross, as we look back and read 1 Kings chapters 5 to 7, we should see Jesus. Jesus, an offspring of David, a wise son, a perfectly obedient king, a king of peace and rest, a king described as a chosen and precious foundation stone whose kingdom shall know no end. Jesus, a wise builder, who will destroy the temple made with human hands and in 3 days build another, not made with hands. Jesus, a perfectly obedient and pure king. He was and is worthy to enter both the glorious and terrifying presence of the Lord in the inner sanctuary, the most holy place. Jesus, a chosen, established king, God's Christ, who sits on the throne and to whom belongs praise and honour and glory and power forever and ever. Jesus, through whom we have confidence to enter the most holy place by his blood, from whom flows streams of living water, and who can cleanse our hearts and wash our bodies with pure water. Jesus is the perfectly obedient king through whom the Lord's promises of relationship and rest are ultimately fulfilled. And concerning the temple, well, do you not know that you are God's holy temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? This is what 1 Kings chapters 5 to 7 was foreshadowing, not a temple made of stone and wood, but a living, walking body, with Christ himself as the chief cornerstone. And in Jesus, we are being built together to become a temple in which God lives by his Spirit. In Jesus, we are the temple, and God lives in us by his Spirit. Therefore, brothers and sisters, let us draw near to God. With full assurance, let us live with him, enjoying a perfect relationship. And let us hold unswervingly to the hope of eternal rest, secured for us through Jesus, God's obedient King. For the Lord who promised is faithful. Amen.